And it's just my day. We're also being photographed. Let's begin with an invocation. Hands out like this. Right hand over the heart. Left hand over the right hand. Right thumb over the left thumb. Spread the fingers. Put your head to the sky. And as it comes down, say, "This is not my body." Into the left shoulder, and then let it drift across the chest while saying, "This is the temple of God." Toward the one, the perfection of love, harmony, and beauty, the only being united with all the illuminated souls who formed the embodiment of the Master, the Spirit of God. So I want to tell a story I like to tell whenever I'm talking about Sufism. Often to a new group, but many of you will be familiar. But still, it's a great story. And I think it really encapsulates so much of what Sufism is about. It's called The Story of Tea. Any of you know this story? So it goes like this. Once there was a time when tea was not known outside of China. But rumors of this tea had spread down the Silk Road into Central Asia. And its reputation was as a celestial or heavenly drink. So rumors of the celestial drink tea made it to a kingdom called Inja, here. And the king of Inja was very curious to know if such a drink actually existed. So he decided to send his ambassadors up the Silk Road into China to ask permission of the emperor to taste this tea for themselves. So the ambassadors go, they make the long journey into China. They're admitted to the emperor's palace. They're given audience with the emperor. And they say, "You know, your radiant highness, son of heaven, we've been sent by the king of here, Inja, to taste the celestial drink tea. And we would like your permission." The emperor of China doesn't deign to actually speak to the ambassadors from the tiny kingdom of here. But he gestures, and his ministers escort them out of the main chamber into a smaller chamber that's beautifully decorated. They lay out tables, they set out the tea, and they serve the tea. And the ambassadors drink it, and they say, "Oh, wonderful. It's both stimulating and relaxing at the same time. It's truly the celestial drink." Very pleased with themselves, they're ready to leave. But now they've succeeded in their mission, so now they decide to take the slow road back. See some of the sights, taste the local cuisine. And so as they're making their way back, they stay in different roadhouses in different places, and they discover something profoundly disturbing to them. Everyone drinks tea in China. Peasants, merchants, people of the upper classes, everybody is drinking the tea. this has got them worried. So they make their way back to the kingdom of India, and they're admitted into the king's presence, and the king says, well, did you succeed in your mission? And they say, yes, but. He says, but what? He says, we made it to China. We were admitted to the palace. We were served something that was called tea. And it was good. But we think maybe they played a joke on us or didn't actually want to serve us the real tea because everybody drank it. Elsewhere in the kingdom of Anja, there was a great philosopher, the greatest philosopher of the whole region. And his great subject was tea. Of all the people in the region, he knew the most about tea. He spent all of his time thinking about tea, collecting information about it, speculating what it could be. He, as the travelers came down the Silk Road, he would interview everyone, and he would get such information as, some say it's a leaf, some say it's dry, some say it's a drink. Some people say that it's golden in color. Some people say a little greenish, some sweet, some bitter. And he collects up all this information, all these tidbits of knowledge, and I'm sure he had a great card catalog going of all of these bits, and had collected the great compendium of knowledge in tea, and had written the authoritative treatise, and became the greatest expert on the subject. Though he never tasted it. In yet another kingdom called Mazab, sectarianism, they'd actually procured a bag of tea. And one day every year, they would take this little sachet of tea and tie four great long strings to it, which were then tied to two great staves, which four big, grim-faced men would carry. Little bag of tea, strong. Through the streets on a particular holy day, and as they passed through the streets on this day, no one had to go to work this day. They all would come to the town square, and as these men passed by with the sacred tea, all would bow down. One year, a visitor to the city was watching this procession, and the sacred tea bag was passing through the city, and he watched people just bow. And he stood standing, and he laughed aloud, and he said, no, idiots, you have to pour boiling water on it. The priest stopped. Their great staves, you know, looked at him aghast, you know. Anger, fear passed, you know, through their minds, and it was expressed in their faces, and then quick with a, you know, a sharp gesture, they pointed to the religious police. And the religious police came, grabbed him, took him aside, and he was quickly executed in horrible ways, hung and dismembered. Because he had suggested the destruction of the tea. Pouring boiling water over it would destroy it. So he was a heretic. Fortunately for us, while he was visiting the town, he'd told the secret of tea to a few friends, a few like-minded individuals in the city of sectarianism. And also, fortunately, before he was executed, he had gotten to give over his belongings to a few of these friends, which included his own private stash of tea. And so the friends, knowing the secret of tea and then having some themselves, decided that they were going to drink it. But they learned the lesson. It's no good talking about it. Don't talk about pouring boiling water over it. And don't drink it in public. So they got together in secret, some back room, and they shared the tea. If anybody happened to come into the room or pass by a window and said, "What are you doing? What are you drinking?" They would say, "Just a little medicine." Over time, through drinking the tea, these friends became wise. And the wisest among them one day, in this circle of tea drinkers, said, "You know what? The one who tastes knows. The one who tastes not knows not. Stop talking about the celestial drink, but serve it at your banquets. Those who like it will ask for more. Those who don't are not fitted to be tea drinkers. Close the shop of argument and open the tea house of experience." Now these friends were already, they all had different little careers. They were already merchants, many of them. Merchants of fabrics, merchants of jewels, doctors, tailors. And being already merchants of these particular products, traveling around the Silk Road, they also became merchants of tea. So wherever they would go in their travels, taking their fabric to one city or another, their jewels to one city or another, when they would arrive in that city, they would stop, find somewhere to sit down, boil a little water, take out the tea, steep it, and then invite whoever might be around to come share some tea with them. They don't talk about it, they just share it. And we're told that this is the origin of the chaikanas, the tea houses, that soon popped up all over the place, and in which the wisdom of the true nature and use of tea was preserved. That's the story of tea. The question is, what is the story about?
Tea.
That's true also. Sufism?
Experience of God.
Experience of God. Spiritual experience. Sufism has a way of, as a spiritual practice, constantly talking about what is Sufism, asking the question, what is Sufism? And then Sufis through the ages have collected these definitions of Sufism, which they then recite to themselves and to each other as a way of constantly reorienting and course correcting, reorienting to Sufi ideals through these various definitions of what is Sufism. This story is one answer to that question. What is Sufism? Yeah. So let's look back at the story a little bit. First, we have the kingdom of India here, where the king doesn't even know if this really exists. And being king, he's not going to go taste it himself. He's going to have tasters go taste it for him. And so he sends his embassy off to China, and they come back, they've returned, they've tasted it, but they have doubts that they've actually tasted it, because they believe that it's a substance, the celestial drink, that is rarefied and only fit to be consumed by the elite, by royalty. And because they see peasants drinking it, it can't be the celestial drink. So they're elitists that don't believe that whatever the tea is belongs to everyone. Spiritual experience. That it is available to people who in this life are considered of the lowest station or those of the highest station. Those who have been on Oprah, those who watch Oprah. Tea is available to all. In the kingdom of there, Anja is the great philosopher, and he is the expert. He's written the great treatise on tea. He knows all of its characteristics, and yet he's never experienced it. What does he know? It's head knowledge. Sufism does not value head knowledge as much as marifa, experiential knowledge, inner knowledge. Then we had the land of sectarianism, where they procured tea, but they worship it in a dry form. This is religion without spirituality. Religion that is not infused with spirit. So they become worshippers of religion, as it were, and not necessarily worshippers of God. They've forgotten that the purpose of a religion is transformation. And the priesthood tends to get into a mode of just self-supporting, supporting the priesthood and the structures of the religion without realizing that the religion itself is a technology for catalyzing transformation in the person. It's because of this that some Sufis created one of these Sufi definitions of what Sufism is. It says, a Sufi's religion is God. A Sufi's religion is God. That definition contains within it a critique of religion. The critique is that it's so easy. You identify yourself as a Christian, as a Jew, as a Muslim. And in this kind of identity that becomes very fixed, you become worshippers of religion and not God. And you have to remember the religion is a mechanism to help you experience God. So the Sufi's religion is God, not the religion that's named Christianity, Judaism, Islam. Meaning, we want to have a direct experience of God somehow. Now, Sufis also tend to say that Sufism has always existed. That it has been there from eternity, that Adam or Adam was the first prophet. That Sufism has always been present as that movement of the heart that is seeking something other, greater, grander, beyond. And wherever that exists, there exists Sufism. And so Sufism has always existed because it is that movement of the heart. Our great Jarahi Sheikh, Sheikh Muzaffar Ozan, said, a river passes through many lands, and in each land they call it by a different name. But there's only one river. That's that movement of the heart. And yet, there is a historically defined Sufism, a Sufism that emerges in a certain cultural context, in a certain period. And that's real also. And so Sufis tend to stay in this tension between the historical context in which it arose and this perennial characteristic as being this just movement of the heart. And I always think it's interesting to talk about the history of Sufism through the etymology of the word Sufi. Where does it come from? Where do we get that from? And Sufis often discuss this. One possible origin of the word Sufi is the word Sufa. Sufa. Which means bench. You can hear in it sofa. Something on which you recline or sit. And it's sometimes said that the word Sufi comes from Sufa. And specifically referring to the Ala Sufa, the people of the bench, or the Ashaba Sufa, the companions of the bench. And the people of the bench, or the companions of the bench, were a group of people in the time of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, who were known to always hang out outside the mosque, outside the masjid. They never left the bench outside. And in their time, they may have been considered lazy or indolent, you know, may have been seen somewhat like the homeless of our time and, you know, criticized. But the truth was, this was a group who were so intoxicated, so God intoxicated, that they could never get enough of their prayers. They could never talk enough about God. And so they never got very far from the mosque. So they just stayed there. So these were the people of the bench, and sometimes people say these were the first Sufis. They were so God intoxicated that they just couldn't stop. Another legend says that the first Sufis didn't have a name. They were a group of companions that were wandering the world. And over centuries, you know, they would, there was a certain turnover in the group, you know, but they remained companions wandering the world. And through in each generation, they were always seeking the kutub, the axis of that particular age, the pole of that age, the person who in that age so specifically represented the divine will that events in that age turned around them. They were the axis of that age. And this nameless group of wanderers in the time of the Prophet Muhammad were magnetically drawn to Medina, where he had his seat. And it's said that in that time, they became associated with Islam because they'd found the kutub, the pole of that age. And so what was this nameless spiritual group then became associated with Islam and what we now think of as historical Sufism was born. And some people say that that nameless group became the people of the bench. That's one origin story based on one name, Sufa. Sufis are inclined to say that Sufi comes from Safa, purity, the word purity. And related to that, we have Tasawuf, Sufism. There's no word Sufism in Arabic, that's an anglicized version. It's tasawuf. Tasawuf means purifying or purification. process of becoming more and more pure. And so it's said that Sufi comes from Safa, purity. Trying to clean out one's being, become more and more pure, a more and more pure vessel for divine love. But historically and linguistically, it becomes fairly clear that the word Sufi is most likely derived from suf, a word that means wool. And likely because the earliest Sufis, even before they had a name, were known as people who wore wool cloaks, tattered, patched woolen cloaks. And in that time, they were mostly known as nusak, ascetics, singular, nasik. And what they were, even before they had the name Sufi, were people who were living a life of protest, spiritual protest. What were they protesting? Now this is approximately 200 years after the time of the Prophet Muhammad. And these ascetics in the desert who wore wool cloaks were protesting what Islam had become. Because in its very rapid success and spread out of Arabia, the empire had become, to their mind, bloated, luxurious, and had strayed from the ideals that were laid out in the Quran al-Karim, the generous Quran, and which were modeled by the Prophet Muhammad. And so now it was a rich empire where people had forgotten about the ideals of Islam. They just acquired wealth and lived lives of luxury and forgot their ideals and forgot the widow, the orphan, and the poor, which the Quran, especially in the early surahs, spends a lot of time saying, take care of the widow, the orphan, and the poor. And now the rich have forgotten them and call themselves Muslims. And so this was a movement, a nameless movement of spiritual protest to leave the luxurious life, to go back into the desert and try to live the ideals of the early days of Islam. And in an interesting way, they saw those ideals as being best lived in their time by certain Christian ascetics who lived in the desert. And they felt that the best model of the lifestyle that they wanted to lead was modeled, was to be modeled on the way of the Prophet Isa, Jesus, who seemed among the prophets to live a more spiritual lifestyle, a more purely spiritual lifestyle. Now that's not to say that they didn't think that the Prophet Muhammad lived a purely spiritual lifestyle, but in the circumstance in which the Quran was revealed and the situation in which he had to become the shepherd of a whole people and see to their protection, the message in his time became mixed with him being both political leader and spiritual leader. And because they saw that this later became a problem, they wanted to model themselves on the way of Jesus. And it says in the Quran that all prophets are equal in essence, and to follow one is to follow all. So, modeling themselves on the ways of these Christian ascetics, who we now know as the desert parents, or the desert mothers and the desert fathers, the Ammas and the Abbas of the desert, they took on the wearing of a wool cloak, which in that time was a way of saying, you know, in the desert especially, to wear wool is to be uncomfortable. It was an ascetic period. It was an ascetic period where they wanted to get past the flesh, right? Even making it uncomfortable and then becoming comfortable with that. So this was a protest movement. So, wool. Little cues here. One of my favorite stories of this kind of cross-fertilization between Christian mystics and early Muslim mystics is actually preserved in the Sufi tradition. One of the greatest of the early Sufis was Ibrahim ibn Adam, whose story kind of mirrors the story of the Buddha, who was a king who left his kingdom in order in a spiritual pursuit. But he tells us in one story that's been preserved that he learned marifa, gnosis, the inner knowing, from a Christian monk called Father Simeon. And he says that one day he went up into the hills to the cave of Father Simeon and sat outside and asked him questions. And he says to Father Simeon, "How long have you been here?" And Father Simeon says, 70 years. And he asks, "On what do you subsist each day? What do you eat each day?" And Father Simeon says, "A single chickpea." And Ibrahim ibn Adam says, "What in your life makes it worthwhile to try to live on one single chickpea a day? How can you do it? What allows you to live on just one chickpea?" Then Father Simeon says, "One day a year, the people from the village down below the hill come up and they decorate the outside of my cave. And they bring me food, and they celebrate the work that I'm doing here in this cave. They celebrate my existence." And he says, "And I'm filled with so much joy that it makes it worthwhile to live on one chickpea a day." Sounds very worldly, right? But then he turns it back to Ibrahim ibn Adam, and he says, "What work of an hour would you do for the glory of eternity? If I do it for this worldly pursuit, what work of just an hour would you do for the glory of eternity?" So he's actually a master here. He made it sound one way. And Ibrahim ibn Adam says, "At that point, marifa entered me. I became filled with the inner knowing." He had a realization. I love this story, because this is a story that says, yes, Sufism is not contained in any one place. It is truly the awakening of the heart. And also, it connects a mystical Abrahamic lineage, because these desert Abbas and Ammas, these desert parents that we celebrate in the Christian mystical tradition, were very clearly the heirs of a group of Hebrew mystics, who are sometimes called the Essenes, from the Greek Essaioi, which is really just a kind of a corruption or transliteration of the Aramaic Hasya, which in Hebrew is probably Hasidim. And if any of you know anything about Judaism today, there is a group of mystics called the Hasidim, the pious ones. And the Essenes were likely, they likely called themselves Hasidim. And so there was this Jewish mystical tradition in the desert that fed the later Christian mystical tradition, which now, if we take this story seriously, fed the Islamic mystical tradition, that there was a clear lineal transmission. So we have the group of ascetics, the Nusach. Historically, it looks like there was a fringe group within them, a little less oriented towards pure asceticism, towards pure protest against the empire, a little more spiritual, a little more oriented toward love. And this group acquired a name, Sufia. And it was a pejorative in its time. This were people from outside calling them wool wearers, people who wear wool, you know, and laughing at them. But over time, they become our forebears in this tradition. Sufism itself tends to combine the two derivations. Suf, wool, with safa, purity. And one master said that a Sufi is one who wears wool over purity. But there's a slow transition from asceticism into becoming an ecstatic tradition oriented around divine love. And this tends to happen around a kind of epicenter of two great teachers. There are many, really, but if I wanted to put my finger on it, I would say it was around in the city of Basra in what is was now Iraq, around a man named Hassan al-Basri, Hassan of Basra, and even more specifically around a woman, Rabia al-Adawiya. And many of the stories even place Hassan al-Basri at her feet, asking her questions. And it's from her that we get such a sense of her divine, her intoxication with God, her great love of God, and her language around loving God was so profound that I feel as if she was like the stone that dropped in the water that sent the ripples of divine love throughout the tradition so that it reoriented over time, almost exclusively to divine love. Now, of course, those early Sufis who were wanting to model themselves on the way of Jesus had the example of love from Christianity and Jesus' talk of love, but it was also there in the Quran from the beginning. The Quran says he loves them and they love him. It puts this emphasis on this reciprocal relationship of love between God and us. But Rabia al-Adawiya, this former slave, you know, the favorite child of her father, who loses her, both her parents and her entire family in a plague, and you know, and as war and famine sweep through her land, she loses her little, I think it was a sister, that she was her last connection. She's sold into slavery, does this menial labor for a man who's not very kind. But at a certain point, as he's watching her, she's constantly speaking to someone. She's constantly speaking to God. And one day hears God answer. And thinks maybe he shouldn't be enslaving this young woman. And frees her. And then she sets out on the road and she never turns back. Though said to be a very beautiful woman, she never marries. And spends the rest of her life pursuing a path of divine love. And she says extraordinary things like, this great imagery, she would go out on her rooftop at night and talk with God as her divine beloved. And she'd say things like, I've loved you with two loves, one that's unworthy of you, and one that's completely lost in you. Two loves, one that's unworthy of you and one that's lost in you. The one that's unworthy of you is the one where I still think of you as you. Me loving the divine beloved. There's still two of us. The greater love is where I lose even the sense of myself in you. There's only you. Is another great one. I'm sure I noted it. Yeah. Yeah, she says, if I worship you for fear of hell, then send me there. If I worship you desiring heaven, then bar the gates. But if I worship you for your own sake, then do not deny me the vision of your eternal beauty. And this goes with this great image of her. My favorite image of her is of her, they say, she walked down the streets of Basra one evening with a torch in one hand and a bucket of water in the other hand. She's walking through the streets, this beautiful woman. And the Sufis that are along the street say, Lady Rabia, what are you doing? And she says, I'm going to set fire to heaven and douse the flames of hell. So that those who only desire heaven for pleasure, as an escape from this world, that heaven will no longer exist. And those who worship God out of some fear of hell, I'm going to douse the flame so that will no longer exist, so that people will know the true nature of service in this world is out of love. You love for its own sake, not for reward and not because of fear of punishment. So she was extraordinary. And I feel that she set the mark on Sufism that would spread through it and transform it over time from an ascetic tradition into and a set ecstatic tradition oriented to divine love. As it makes this traditional this transition over time, there are more and more Sufi ecstatics. And practices are evolved, dhikr Allah, the remembrance of God, as a practice, a mantric kind of practice that takes one to a place where we lose the sense of self and only exist in a swelling remembrance of God. And these early Sufis would have sessions that were called sama, hearing, playing music together, reciting poetry, getting in, and often this poetry was secular love poetry, but then reoriented to a relationship with God as the beloved. And many of them would get into ecstatic states of experiencing that divine love or experiencing divine union. One of them who was very famous for these ecstatic states was called Al-Hallaj. We have Hallaj in the room. And Al-Hallaj was famous and infamous among some For in one ecstatic state, uttering what's called a shat, an ecstatic utterance, where he said, Anal Haq, I am the truth. And very famously after that, being executed, hanged, dismembered. Because it's said in the tradition, there is a historical story around this also, that's similar but not quite the same. But because to the literal mindedness of most of the leaders of the period and where he was saying such a thing, they understood him to be saying with Anal Haq, I am the truth, that his ego was now subsuming God. That his ego had become so large that he thought he was God. And really, it's quite the opposite. In expressing this, he was saying his ego had become obliterated by God, or absorbed in God. But that couldn't be understood by those who hadn't tasted. Does the story sound familiar now? Al-Halaj is the man who calls out, no, you've got to pour boiling water on it. You have to have an experience. The boiling water is the infusion of divine love that makes all of the religion make sense. It's just dry before that. So the story of tea, it's also telling us the history of Sufism. That spiritual experience existed somewhere, and people looked at it in different ways. And some thought it was a rarefied thing only to be experienced by the elite. Some people kept themselves aloof from it by only relating to it as knowledge and head knowledge, not deep knowledge, not experiential knowledge. And then some people had forgotten that there was experience altogether and left it dry. Al-Halaj points out what is wrong with this, and he's killed for it. But he passes on the secret to a small group of friends. But as we see in the story, his story is also considered a cautionary tale. The people who originally told this story were a group of Sufis that were not called Sufis, they were called the Khwajagan, the Masters of Wisdom. And they felt that we need to be more cautious now about the way we talk about spiritual experience. These shatihat, these great ecstatic experiences that are uttered in public, doesn't necessarily help the cause. It doesn't necessarily spread Sufism in the way it needs to be spread. And so Sufism at that point starts to go underground to some degree. And yet, as it goes underground, it becomes much more successful because it's in the next couple hundred years that we see the great flowering of Sufism and the origin of all the great Sufi orders. So that wisdom was contained in that statement in the story. The one who tastes knows. The one who tastes not knows not. Stop talking about the celestial drink. But serve it at your banquets. When you have people over, serve the tea. Share the wisdom. Those who like it will ask for more. Those who do not are not fitted to be tea drinkers. Close the shop of argument. Open the tea house of experience. Merchant Samuel Lewis, many of you know, Sufi Sam, had a very nice paraphrase of a little longer statement by Al-Ghazali, one of the great early Sufis, who spent much of his life making Sufism acceptable to larger Islam. But Murshid Sam said, Sufism is a school of experience, not dogmas. And that's also the story of tea. That Sufism is a school of experience, not dogma. So the emphasis becomes one's personal experience. We're not going to tell you what to believe, but we'll share the experiences. It's not that Sufism doesn't have very specific teachings and ideas, as we've discussed, you know, oriented around divine love and specific practices, but it does not put an emphasis on saying, you must believe. It just says, here, taste. If you like it, maybe you're fitted to be a tea drinker. But in some ways, the emphasis of Sufism is to discover God for yourself. As Hazrat Inayat Khan would put it, to discover the divine ideal, the God ideal. That's your God. The God that you can relate to and that is born out of your experience. It's not necessarily the God, but it's the one you're interfacing with as you grow your understanding of the divine. But Sufism is a tradition that is oriented around sharing teachings, sharing practices, gathering in groups to do that, but not of saying you must believe anything. Thus, the merchants of tea just tended to take it wherever they went. Wherever the Sufi went, the tea went with them. Sufism went with them. And when they sat down to talk to somebody, Sufism was transmitted by the love that was in their being. And maybe they would do a little dhikr with that person. But they became merchants of tea, merchants of Sufism in this way. And our story says this is the origin of the chaikhanas, the tea houses that sprung up all over Central Asia. These are the Sufi turuq, the Sufi orders, the great Sufi orders, and the khankas, the gathering places of the Sufis. And the four great Sufi orders that first emerged were the Chishti order, the Naqshbandi order, the Qadiri order, the Surwardi order, all with specific emphases, very powerful in themselves, and then many branching orders came off of them. The Chishti order, which has its origins in Central Asia, but doesn't really flower and come into its fullness until one master takes it into India. That master is Khwaja Muinuddin Chishti. And in India, the Chishti lineage becomes something slightly different and fascinating, in that today in the Chishti lineage you have fused into it practices that are clearly related to the yoga traditions of India. Pranayama practices, alternate nostril breathing practices. And it's preserved in the tradition how Baba Farid had a dialogue with particular yoga masters, etc. So this is preserved in this lineage. It's also the lineage that is associated with the music we heard this morning, the Qawwali music. That's a particular style of Sufi music that is associated with the Chishti lineage. And out of this lineage also comes Hazrat Inayat Khan, who in 1910 was charged by his own master in the Chishti lineage to, as he said, fare forth into the world and with the harmony of your, no, how does it go? Do you remember? Fare forth into the world and harmonize east and west with your music and spread the knowledge of Sufism. For to this end, you were blessed by God, he was told. And Hazrat Inayat Khan was one of the greatest musicians of his day in India, classical musicians. And he did come into the West in 1910. And ostensibly as a musician, giving concerts, giving an example of the music of the East, as they might bill it, you know, in those days. And he brought his brothers and cousins, and they would play different concerts. But also he began at that time to give talks on Sufism. Came to the United States, came to Great Britain, was in France, went to Russia. But in the United States in 1910, in San Francisco, or was it, was at least in the Bay Area, Southern California, he gives a talk hosted by a Vedanta center there, by Swami Paramananda, actually a disciple of Swami Vivekananda. And he gives a talk that is attended by a woman named Ada Martin. And Ada Martin was a Jewish woman who was daughter of Russian Jewish immigrants, and she was already into everything spiritual in the day. And she saw Hazrat Inayat Khan, and he saw her, and there was an immediate meeting of hearts. And she became, as far as we know, the first Western murid, and later the first murshida, authorized spiritual teacher of the lineage. And I brought her picture in. This is a picture of her right here. And just this last November, my partner Alia and I went to find her grave. And it apparently was, there was nobody looking for it for a very long time. And so nobody seemed to know where it was, but with the help of Pir Shabda of the Ruhaniyat and Wali Ali and a whole team of researchers that they had, we found out where she was buried and went and did a small pilgrimage to her grave. So it's just a side note, but it's wonderful. But she brought up a very interesting question for him. Here he is, a Muslim Sufi charged with spreading Sufism in the Western world, and he's very universalist, and he holds all of the four great lineages of Sufism. But the question is it necessary to make her a Muslim? Or any of the people that are attracted to what is being said? And the answer apparently was no, that was not necessarily his mission, though he kept that practice and maintained it. But, as he saw, they were already people of the book. There was no reason to ask them to be anything different. But in putting an emphasis on the Sufism, and not necessarily all of the expressions of Sufism as it would express in Islam, Sufism began to look like a body of teachings and wisdom that could be applied no matter what your particular religious tradition was, and it could be applied in such a way that it would turn it on. Whatever was dry, the tea was just waiting there, it was dry, but it became the boiling water that infused it and brought it to life. The Sufism was the catalyzing element. And thus we got the emphasis that became in Inayati Sufism, and or is sometimes called Universalist Sufism. And when in a Sufi lineage you you have an element of novelty that's added, a new emphasis is added, there's usually a name is added to the lineage. So first we had Chishti from Chisht, the city of Chisht in Central Asia. And then at a certain point with Khwaja Nizamuddin, it becomes the Chishti Nizami lineage. And then with Hazrat Inayat Khan and this new emphasis, it becomes the Chishti Nizami Inayati lineage, which we generally just call the Inayati lineage. Now, one of the questions I posed in my short description of what we were going to be talking about today, or what I was going to be talking about, was some people ask, is that still Sufism? Is it still Sufism, this Inayati version of it, this universalist version? It's an interesting question, but I think fairly simple to answer. We maintain the orientation toward divine love. We maintain the practices that cultivate that experience of divine love. We honor the silsila, the lineage, and all the masters and mistresses. I mean that in a really good sense. All those women that are not named in the lineage, but who have fed into it and influenced it. We maintain that our connection to that. And so I think it's hardly a question. Sufism has always maintained its tension with its universalist values and the religious expression of many of its inherents, the religion and the infusing element that brings that religion to life, religion and spirituality, as it were. And as I was thinking about this, is anything really, really, really different from what Khwaja Moinuddin laid out in his great mandate to the Sufis at his death? He gave a final sermon, and it was very beautiful. And I went back to look at it to see, is there anything that we're doing that's different from this or out of phase with it? And I want to read it to you, just in closing. So this is 800 years old. These were the final sermon of Khwaja Moinuddin Chishti, who brought Chishti Sufism into India. Love all and hate none. Mere talk of peace will get you nothing. Mere talk of God and religion will not take you far. Bring out all the latent powers of your being and reveal the full magnificence of your immortal self. Be charged with peace and joy and scatter them wherever you are and wherever you go. Be a blazing fire of truth and a beautiful blossom of love and a soothing balm of peace with your spiritual light. Dispel the darkness of ignorance. Dissolve the clouds of discord and war and spread goodwill, peace, and harmony among the people. Never seek any help, charity, or favors from anyone except God. Never go to the court of kings, nor refuse to bless and help the needy and the poor, the widow or the orphan if they come to your door. This is your mission, to serve the people. Carry it out dutifully and courageously, so that I, as your pure Murshid, may not be ashamed of any shortcomings on your part before Almighty God and our holy predecessors in the Sufi silsila on the Day of Judgment. Hazrat Inayat Khan's proposed another definition of Sufism. Sufism is the religion of the heart, the religion in which it is most important to seek God in the heart of human beings. Hopefully this is what we're doing. So I just wanted to contextualize. What is Sufism? Come back to it and reorient to what are our values? What are our origins? However we understand it, historically, mythologically. Come back into that, because that is a Sufi practice, to continually reorient it to what is it to be a Sufi? To learn the definitions, to learn the stories, and then use them as a practice to challenge ourselves to be living that each day. We're out of time.
Oh, perfect. Perfect.
your talk was perfect.
Yes.
Thank you, it's so beautiful.
Well, we should eat. But I want to close with a dedication, just the way we entered, with an invocation. It's exactly the same, but you gather in a circle, it becomes a ritual space. And so you enter it intentionally and you leave it intentionally. So right hand over the heart, left hand over the right hand, right thumb over the left thumb, spread the fingers. I think of this as a winged heart. Put your head to the sky, and as it comes down, say, this is not my body. Chin to the left shoulder, and let it just drift across your chest as you say, this is the temple of God. And that's how we go out, knowing that this is the temple of God. We're carrying God in the Holy of Holies, the Sanctum Sanctorum in the heart, and we're emissaries of God when we go out. Thank you so much.
Thank you.